All right, shall we begin? So this is about kind of another attempt at an alternative Sunday school. What we wish we could get at church if we're not getting it at church. What we could bring into lessons at church if we wanted to. Or if you're not doing church anymore, where are you going to get some brain food from? And we're going to look at kind of different aspects of what we hope to get from a Sunday school lesson at its best. So this is really for everyone. It's ideas if you are still at a Sunday school and able to bring it. But I'm just really excited about TikTok because it's a fantastic educational tool. Obviously, the algorithms help, and you can get sucked in, and then 2 hours have passed, and everything, your house is burned down, and you kind of emerge. Lynn and I do TikTok interventions with each other. We have to like snatch the phone from each other's hands because it's been in, you know, enough hours now. And but what's brilliant about it is it's small, bite-sized chunks of information. And if you're getting your algorithms right, you're learning a lot of really important, interesting stuff that experts in their fields are condensing down. And there's always this sense of this tension between science and religion that we kind of talk about a lot. And at its best, Mormonism as a general thing has been brilliant at this. But there can be a tendency of religion to have one book written allegedly in the Bronze Age, probably a bit later, and they now know everything. It's the guardian of all truth. And science is more about, I've got all this knowledge and books, but I still don't know enough. There's going to be more, an open canon. And technically, Mormonism should be that. And Community of Christ model that well. They're always adding to their books of scripture. LDS Mormonism hasn't managed that for a century now, since 1918, except for clearing up a small issue of institutional racism, which I don't think really counts as anything particularly brilliantly new. But let's go right to the mouth of the beast, as it were. I love 2 Nephi 29, and it says, "For behold, I shall speak unto the Jews, and they shall write it, and I shall also speak to the Nephites, and they shall write it, and I shall also speak to the other tribes of the house of Israel, which I have led away, and they shall write it." And usually the narrative stops there, because it's a bit racist, you know, the biblical stuff. It's all about the tribes of Israel, you know. Other nations and cultures in the world only matter if they've got Jewish ancestors. But in these sort of 14 or so words, the Book of Mormon in one verse opens up a wormhole to an entirely different approach to religion. And I shall also speak to all nations of the earth, and they shall write it. All, no exceptions. That gives Mormons permission to go to any religious tradition, ancient or modern, all of it, and look for the good in that system. You know, Joseph Smith kind of modeled this with the Apocrypha, which he said, well, read it, you know, get what you can from it, look for the spiritual food there. And this is in the scripture. And they back this up with further statements. Brigham Young. Joseph Smith said similar things, but Brigham said, "How gladly would we understand every principle pertaining to science and art, and become thoroughly acquainted with every intricate operation of nature, and with all the chemical changes that are constantly going on around us. How delightful this would be, and what a boundless field of truth and power is open for us to explore. We are only just approaching the shores of the vast ocean of information that pertains to this physical world, to say nothing of that which pertains to the heavens, to angels and celestial beings, to the place of their habitation, to the manner of their life and their progress, to still higher degrees of perfection." We didn't mention Quakers with hats, but anyway. Living off the sun. My Masonic Mormon friends say that's masonry. Its influence there, this idea of all truth and bringing that in. And that's part of the temple symbols as well. And he also said, "Mormonism, so-called, embraces every principle pertaining to life and salvation for time and eternity, no matter who has it. If the infidel has got truth, it belongs in Mormonism. The truth and sound doctrine possessed by the sectarian world, and they have a great deal, all belong to this church. As for their morality, many of them are morally just as good as we are. All that is good, lovely, and praiseworthy belongs to this church and kingdom. Mormonism includes all truth. There is no truth but what belongs to the gospel. It is life, eternal life. It is bliss. It is the fullness of all things in the gods and in the eternity of the gods. And these are from the Brigham Young study manual. This was in our Sunday school curriculum, you could argue, or Priesthood and Relief Society for the LDS Church. It's always been there. We're just not doing it very well, or totally ignoring it. Or our prophet says, don't take counsel from non-believers, which is the exact opposite of everything we've just read there. So let's start. How do we start to navigate, whether in or outside of active participation in our religion? What's it all about? What are the big ideas we're thinking about? So here we have what most religious people think is God's favorite planet, which is in this planetary system, in this God's favorite galaxy of the many billions. And when you start to just look at what's out there, it creates a sense of awe. It creates a sense of the ludicrousness of the stuff we stress ourselves about when you look at the scale of existence. And science is really giving this gift to us. We have a sense now that there was the Big Bang. It could have been the result of a wormhole farting in another universe. There are all kinds of ways that could happen. This isn't necessarily the only universe, but the one we're in seems to have started with this massive explosion, and eventually galaxies form. And the telescopes that we're sending out there, Hubble, has been able to see that far back in time from the Big Bang with the early redshift galaxies. And I'm assuming James Webb is going to see even further back. That's kind of the point of the new one up there. One of our great, in Britain, sort of popularisers of science is Brian Cox. Speak to us, Brian.
What is the one fact about the universe that blows your mind the most?
Well, just the size and scale of it. In the piece of the universe we can see, there are something like, roughly, 2 trillion galaxies. I'm counting them all, but that's an estimate based on surveys of the local universe. 2 trillion. 2,000 billion galaxies. And each galaxy is, let's say, around the size of the Milky Way. Some are bigger, some are smaller, but the Milky Way has 400 billion stars in it. It takes light over 100,000 years to cross a galaxy, and there are 2 trillion of them in a piece of the universe we can see. And we're very sure that that piece that we can see is a small bit of what may be an infinite universe beyond. We don't know, actually. And I always say, don't get worried about that, because nobody can picture it. It is impossible to visualize the scale of the universe.
So that's quite, he gets philosophical, you know. He talks about, he doesn't just say, here are these facts. He says, well, how are we to respond to it? What do we make of that? So it's important to fact check. Other sources would say, where he said most galaxies around the size of ours, others are saying that actually the galaxy we're in, the Milky Way, is one of the larger galaxies out there. Most of them are a bit smaller. But even allowing for that, you arrive at this number of about 2 trillion galaxies with about 1 billion stars, 1,000 million stars, solar systems within each one. You may have heard of the Hubble Extreme Deep Fields. What they did is they pointed the camera at a very tiny empty piece of the sky, and over extremely long exposures, revisiting it regularly, they gradually received enough light for this image to occur. And within that tiny space, they could see 5,500 galaxies, which they estimate is only 10% of the galaxies in that sort of wedge of space that they were looking at. And within it, all these different forms of galaxies, the redder ones are further back in time, further away. Now, that's big, awesome stuff, and we tend at church to kind of attach it to, well, you know, especially if I'm meant to become a god and make these galaxies one day. I know that's not the official line anymore in Mormonism, but I'm like, excuse me? Of course we're not going to have our own planet. We can have our own galaxies. Like, think big. There's enough room out there. There's trillions of them. You know, we haven't had trillions of people yet, at least on our world. So let's take a moment to kind of decompress what can be our inherited pressure. So if we're concerned by toxic perfectionism, let's take a moment with Tom Fell on TikTok and his wisdom.
I'm tired of having goals. I'm sick of improving personally and professionally. Accomplishing anything is massively overrated. I'm exhausted of being held to any standard whatsoever. I'm at peace with never reaching full optimization. I'm ready to retire after accomplishing almost nothing and saving very little. I don't want to hit metrics or milestones. I don't want to look back at how far I've come. I don't want to overcome adversity and emerge as a better person. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, and I don't want to take it. I want to aimlessly meander until I wander off a cliff. I want to lay down in the forest and be slowly consumed by vines. I want to burn my calendar leading to a sinkhole. Learning and growing sucks. This is who I am. Any improvement is purely accidental. I'm being pulverized by the crushing weight of daily structure. Life is chaos, and so many things are outside of my control. No thing brings me happiness. It only comes from within. We're here on Earth to fart around. Don't let anybody tell you different.
I love that. I listen to that every week now. We're here to fart around and don't let anyone tell you anything different. Because the stuff we stress ourselves over, really, that is just very refreshing, isn't it? You know, it's like, why are we giving us so much pressure? And he has further advice, you know, if we're worried about death, which is a major concern, and we'll hear Brian Cox's thoughts about that in a minute.
I don't want to live forever. Stop spending millions of dollars to reverse aging. We get that you're having a great time, but we're all really struggling. Please, please, please just make healthcare more affordable. Inject yourself with young people's blood as much as you want, but do not lengthen my lifespan. I love my life, but I'm hemorrhaging money just to stay alive and well. This all just a thin-mill attempt to get more labor out of us. Dying is my one true shot at retirement. I don't want to work till I'm 105. I don't want to watch the world turn strange and unrecognizable. I don't want to see all the politicians I hate serve another 50 years. I want to be released from this pale flesh prison and liberated by eternal non-existence. I want to feel the crushing weight of time grind my bones into dust. I want the sweet release of debts to take me away from subscriptions, taxes, and healthcare costs. I want to return to the cosmos unburdened by KPIs, compliance training, and quarterly reviews. Debt is my only defense from the crushing weight of unchecked capitalism. Well, back to creating value for shareholders.
There you go. This is Tom Fell. Tom Fell.
Yeah.
Yeah. His TikTok channel is Tom Fell, Is He Okay? Or something like that. Anyway, he's a genius. Very good.
He's a genius.
So in TikTok, in a pithy thing, you can get really big issues kind of brought down to their essential essence. And that's a challenge which one day I'll understand with my 6-hour episodes. I'm a bit pushed for time, so I don't think we'll have loads of time for that. This was a brilliant, just the perspectives that going online can give you. Rather than the usual quite limited life experience of the range of people in the typical Sunday school lesson. This is by an autistic guy, and he basically says, you know, people keep telling us to be medium, like you're too much of this, you're too under, you're too stimulated, you're understimulated, you've got too much of a strong sense of justice, so tone it down. And he's like, what's wrong with having a sense of justice? We'll listen to him, he's brilliant. Let's go.
Hi, my name is Jean Daniel. I'm autistic. But if you're not, that's okay. I'm here to teach you the basic social and communication skills you need to get along better with the autistic person in your life. Don't worry, these are learnable skills. Does it feel condescending when I say it like that? Welcome to our world. All right, in more seriousness. Apparently, you autistic people had a meeting, a secret meeting where you decided that there's a medium amount to do everything. And many of the communication problems and social awkwardness issues that come up with us autistic folks is because we don't know you're not.
Sorry, I'm pushing buttons. Don't let me push buttons.
No, you shouldn't push buttons.
I'm trying to just take. It's the volume right. Try not to deafen you all. That's what that's about. There we go. Down a little bit. There we go. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Jean Daniel. I'm autistic. But if you're not, that's okay. I'm here to teach you the basic social and communication skills you need to get along better with the autistic person in your life. Don't worry, these are learnable skills. Does it feel condescending when I say it like that? Welcome to our world. All right, in more seriousness. Apparently, you idealistic people had a meeting, a secret meeting, where you decided that there's a medium amount to do everything. And many of the communication problems and social awkwardness issues that come up with us autistic folks is because we don't know your non-communicated medium amount. We can see this in some of the curious diagnostic criteria for autism written by non-autistic people, such as hyperlexia, that is, being able to read too well, or an extreme sense of fairness and justice, caring about things being fair or just too much, or our special interests, the fact that when we like something, we tend to want to know all about it. All of those diagnostic criteria show that in your world, there's a medium amount. A medium amount of skill a child should have at reading. A medium amount of caring about fairness. A medium amount of enthusiasm for the things you love. This can also affect things like, you want us to speak in a medium volume, and we don't No, so we're often considered too quiet or too loud. You want us to speak a medium amount, so autistic people are often told that we talk too much or we're nonverbal. There's a medium amount. I've had a lot of miscommunications around a medium quantity of communication. That is, if a friend or even a potential date says, hey, let's meet next Thursday at 6 p.m., I will send back a message saying, okay, see you Thursday at 6 p.m. and then not follow up. And then they don't show up because apparently we were supposed to keep reaffirming that time. But if I follow up too much, that's creepy. We're supposed to have a medium amount of enthusiasm for our romantic interests. So saying, hi, I would love to go on a date with you is not enough. That seems cold and clinical. But emulating what we see in pop culture, again, that's too much and that's creepy. In all of these things, there's a constant medium amount that is expected of us. A medium amount of enthusiasm for our work. Even a medium amount of eloquence. We're told that we're nonverbal or that we're robotic and monotone in how we speak, but if we try to correct it, you sound like a newscaster and everything you say is fake. There's constant exhaustion in being autistic with trying to know exactly what you want when you haven't said it. So if you're finding that the autistic person in your life is too little or too much, you have two options. At least two ethically good options. Or at least two ethically possible options. One, get over it. I know, that kind of empathy for somebody different than you is something that non-autistic people historically seem to struggle with. Two, communicate what you want directly and clearly and stop assuming people can know.
I love that. There's a lot of Asperger's in my family. So I got excommunicated for being too much. I was tone policed out of the church.
Too much
in the language I used in my criticisms of general authorities, backed up by hours of recent quoting. And that's literally what I was next for. So I'm like, hang on a minute, I got X for my disability. Brilliant. I've lots of thoughts. Is that also Lynn? Anything autistic is the same for all men, so you have to explain things. We can't read your minds. And back to Brian, he kind of asked some of these existential questions about life and death.
There's only one interesting question in philosophy, and I don't really mean it, but I think it sounds funny. But the interesting question is, what does it mean to live a finite, fragile life in an infinite, eternal universe? So that's not that funny, right? It's a good question. I think the answer is that, sort of paradoxically, whilst we are definitely physically insignificant, the Earth is one planet around one star, the most 400 billion stars in one galaxy, amongst 2 trillion galaxies in a small patch of the universe, right? So we're definitely small. We can't argue with that, we're just specks of dust. But if you think about what we are, we're just collections of atoms, right? Some of them are as old as time, the other ones, everything else other than hydrogen in our bodies was made in stars, right? All cooked over billions of years. And we're this pattern that can think so suddenly, as the great Carl Sagan said, you have a means by which the universe understands and explores itself, which is us.
Without life, the universe is by definition meaningless. It's clearly, but meaning enters the universe with consciousness. And consciousness is a property of living things. And so without living things, there's no meaning. So I think that, let's flip it around. If this is the only planet in the Milky Way galaxy that currently hosts an intelligent civilization, then it's the only island of meaning in a sea of 400 billion stars. And therefore, we have a tremendous responsibility, notwithstanding our physical insignificance, to protect this island of meaning. If we mess it up, we will be responsible, if that's the case, for annihilating meaning, perhaps forever, in a galaxy.
Yeah, no pressure again. But again, you can take that lots of ways. You know, you can see the healthiness from Tom of just stop stressing about everything. It's okay to be average, or just you're going to die soon anyway. So, like, what's the point of overstressing? You've also got, if you want to be enthusiastic, go for it, because we're the only meaning in the galaxy that we're aware of, and this is an incredible moment, and this is one of the biggest shifts for me in listening to scientists talking about their worldview that's really helped me to see things differently. That even if you only believe your life exists for your mortal probation, as it were, therefore it's 10 times more valuable, it's infinitely more valuable. Every moment you're alive, this is it, this is heaven, this is your experience, this is the moment. Be present, be with your children. Don't be abandoning them to go off and do church jobs or something like that. You know, just savor every minute. And if you want to get passionate about stuff, go for it. So these things get thinking in lots of different directions at once. What I'm going to show a few things to kind of speak to the crushing disappointment that mostly LDS people seem to be experiencing at times, or certainly in our community.
What's the reason, in like a simple sentence, that you are an ex Mormon?
I got bored in Mormon Sunday school,
I
started to read all the footnotes.
I mean, it's that simple. She got bored in Sunday school and actually read the footnotes. And that was the beginning of her journey, especially with that Revelations in Context book.
The first guy I know.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cool. Awesome. And sometimes we can feel like this in a religion, or any community that has a very strict sort of sense of towing the party line and saying the same things.
This is one of the scariest clips you might ever see online. Check this out.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities,
the El Paso Las Cruces communities,
Eastern Iowa communities,
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are truly proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS4 News produces.
But we are concerned about the whole community
plaguing our country.
We're generating a biased and false news as we become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish the same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish the same fake stories without checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some members of the media platform were such their own personal lives and an agenda to control exactly what they say. And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
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 To save the day, follow for more.
Okay, so Fox News doing its thing, but is that what you experience when you go to church on a Sunday?
Oh, yes, yes,
for me. This is really powerful, love it.
What the hell did you expect me to do? You told me to love my neighbors, to model the life of Jesus, to be kind and considerate, and to stand up for the lowly. You told me to love people, consider others more important than myself. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in the sight. We sang it together, pressing the volume pedal and leading our hearts into the chorus. You told me to love my enemies, to even do good to those who wish for bad things. You told me to never hate anyone and to always find ways to encourage people. You told me it's better to give than to receive, to be last instead of first. You told me that money doesn't bring happiness and can even lead to evil. But taking care of the needs of others brings great joy and life to the soul. You told me that Jesus looks at what I do for the least of these as the true depth of my faith. You told me to focus on my own sin instead of trying to police it in others. You told me to be accepting and forgiving. I paid attention. I took every lesson, and I did what you told me. But now you call me a libtard, a queer lover. You call me woke, a backslider. You call me a heretic, a child of the devil. You call me a false prophet, a reprobate, leading people to the gates of hell. You call me soft, a snowflake, a socialist. What the hell did you expect me to do? You passed out the What Would Jesus Do bracelets. I took it to heart. I thought you were serious. Apparently not. We were once friends. But now the lines have been drawn. You hate nearly all the people I love. You stand against nearly all the things I stand for. I'm trying to see a way forward, but it's hard when I survey all the hurt and the harm and the darkness that comes in the wake of your beliefs and presence. What the hell did you expect me to do? I believed it all the way. I'm still believing it all the way, which leaves me wondering, what happened to you?
Yeah! Now, when we get together and we agonize all of these issues within our church and our denominations and everything, I think it's important sometimes to step back and realize how utterly ridiculous we all sound. There's this phrase you get of the idea of religious people arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin is something, it's a phrase that comes up. So I really love this. How super religious people sound to the non-religious from Ghostbusters.
Closer to the traveler. He will come in one of the pre-chosen forms. During the rectification of the Valdrani, the traveler came as a large moving torch. Then, during the third reconciliation of the last of the McKendrick supplicants, they chose a new form for him, that of a giant s'more. Many shucks and fools knew what it was to be roasted in the depths of the s'more that day, I can tell you.
I look back now and think that's probably what my discussions as a missionary about the apostasy and restoration sounded like to the poor general public.
He went to Matabike
Place
or something years ago, and it was like a party scenario. There's always somebody who wants to bring Jesus into every conversation. Yeah. I think, well, that's me.
Yeah. Here's the thing, we a lot of us are disappointed with finding out that our prophets and heroes were quite broken people and rather messed up, and you have that difficult choice to make. Do I trust what they taught and brought into my world as a philosophy and religion, even though personally they were awful reprobates, predators of women and all the rest of it? Science has the same problem, so I just thought this was an interesting kind of counterpoint to that.
Most historical scientists were dicks. Now, I say this not to be controversial or to incite some sort of a debate or anything like that. It's just a statement of fact. We know this. Let's look at Erwin Schrödinger. He was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, famous for his work on quantum mechanics. As a man, he kept a little black book to list all the women and girls that he had affairs with, including a rating system. And when I say girls, I mean girls. He claimed he had a right to them because of his genius. Now, the girls he didn't achieve a physical connection with, thankfully due to the intervention of family members, he referred to as his unrequited loves. Yeah. What about Nikola Tesla, arguably the most influential inventor of the 20th century? In 1935, Tesla wrote an article for Liberty magazine where he said that we should stop making people that are inferior. Eugenics, because we're talking about eugenics. He wrote this down. This isn't like a second-hand account. He said that the sterilization of criminals and the insane was insufficient and that we needed to start making marriage more difficult to prevent the breeding of the unfit. Now, this dude also fell in love with a pigeon, so there's that. What about Albert Einstein? Nobel Prize-winning theoretical physicist, considered a genius, probably the most famous physicist of all time. He met his first wife in 1896 and appeared to be madly in love with her, for a time. In 1912, he started having an affair with his cousin Elsa, and he would write her letters and talk shit about his current wife, calling her an unfriendly, humorless creature. Again, like he wrote these things down. He said to his cousin mistress, "I treat my wife as an employee whom I cannot fire." And that's exactly what he did to her by sending her a list of rules to follow, saying things like, "You will see to it that my clothes and linen are kept in order, that I am served 3 regular meals a day in my room. You will renounce all personal relations with me, except when these are required to keep up social appearances. You will expect no affection from me." Sounds like a lovely guy. Now, Maleva finally left him in 1919 and he immediately married Elsa, but then later said that this was just a marriage of convenience while he continued to have multiple affairs with younger women. Dare I bring up Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize winning physicist, viewed as one of the most brilliant and influential figures in physics, and there is the biggest cult of personality that surrounds this man. People revere Feynman. He's cool, he's charming, he's brilliant, he's attractive. What we know about him and his views, again, comes from his own writings at the time. In his books, we learn that he adopted the mindset of a pickup artist by treating women as if they were worthless and cruelly lashing out at them when they rejected his advances. He admits to working and holding meetings in strip clubs. As a professor at Caltech, he drew naked portraits of his female students. Sometimes he pretended to be an undergraduate student to trick younger women into sleeping with him. When I talk about a scientist, I'm never thinking about who the person is. I'm only ever thinking about their contributions. Nowadays, we wouldn't have that approach. Times have changed, and who you are is tied into what you do, and we don't tolerate this crap anymore. It changes how we treat people when we lose respect for them. Let's be real. By today's standards, Schrodinger would be in jail. Tesla would probably be some sort of conspiracy nut on TikTok. Einstein would be a controlling, abusive, gaslighting husband. And Feynman probably would be sending dick pics on Insta and Tinder. There's a struggle that we have in general in the world in separating the art from the artist, the science from the scientists. Are we still allowed to revere the work of scientists and artists that we know were objectively terrible people? I don't know the answer to this. I do know that I can't erase the impact that these people have had on science. Like, I will continue to learn and teach the work of Einstein, Feynman, Schrodinger, Tesla, and many, many more, because their names are ingrained in the structure of my field. But when I do, don't mistake my reverence for their work as any form of admiration for their character. They were dicks.
Okay. There's a lot we can read in Sack. Go ahead, yeah.
Obviously, drawing comparisons with Joseph Smith.
Yeah. And Brigham Young and Wilfred, yeah.
But the difference is that Einstein wasn't professing to be something that he wasn't.
Speaking for God.
Yeah. So,
with a morality system that is the opposite of that. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are lots of men in history, you know, like thinking about people like Martin Luther King and people like Nelson Mandela.
Yeah. Adulterous.
By so many people, but they were adulterous men. And it is important to separate. You can't just discount the people that people have done because their morality is questionable. But you can't then immediately transfer that to Joseph Smith, because actually what he was doing is preaching that we should all be chaste and, you know, no sexual attraction, that kind of thing. Yeah. So he wasn't living as he professed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is a difference.
Absolutely. And perhaps the difference there is the scientist can say, "I like these ideas, I find value in them, but the person is awful." Whereas in high demand fundamentalist religion, you're used to the adulation being, "I like these ideas because this person was so great. He's more perfect than me. He was chosen by God to be the vessel of this wisdom. He was the best available." Prophets can see around corners. Oh, some scientific quote. Person, people. And they are the most perfect people walking the earth, according to Sherry Jew. So, you know, absolutely. But what an interesting starting point to have about that conversation. My mum died recently, and I'm dealing with that whole thing of, right, what does that mean? How do I process that? How do I continue her memory? What does it mean that someone that important to you is not physically there anymore? and she had a long journey with Alzheimer's, so it was a gradual process. You know, we lost the person she was many years ago in a way. And I just love this, because one of the big things in Mormonism, and certainly how this Mormonism has held on to it, has been what can we do for our ancestors? And a lot of pressure and tension about servicing them, servicing the dead, and often neglecting your living family to go and do that. But this, I'm quoting Maya Angelou too, everyone's got Maya. And I just love this, and it got me thinking, hang on a minute, let's flip that. What can my ancestors do for me?
You walk into an office, you don't go alone. Bring your people with you. Bring everybody who has loved you with you. Say, Grandma, come listen. Great grandpa, you've been dead all this time, come listen. I have to go in here and have an interview. Come on, auntie. Come on, my friends. Come, let's go. And when you walk in, people don't know what it is about you. They can't take their eyes off you. You may not be cute in the given sense. You may not be fine fashion model size in that particular sense. You may not be any of those things, but they can take their eyes off you. And they say of you, in this incredible way, which is, I don't understand. They say, you know what? She has charisma. You know, what you have is all the...
Thought that was lovely. That often in the LDS Mormon model, you're meant to just have endless guilt that your ancestors are screaming in spirit prison and you need to release them and do your family history work. What about what can they do for you? Think of all that heritage and we get from biology. You know, all of us are an amazing success story. For millions of years, people have successfully passed their genes on to us. And your life has all of that heritage behind it and all that effort, all that struggle to get you to where you are right now. Bring them with you into the room. You know, you are a family, you're a tribe of people, you're a long heritage. Have that be internalized in a more healthy way. Another great thing about modern technology and the internet is we can revisit things in history. This is a little tribute to our lovely Mexican guest today. That we can, one of the great things about Mormonism is it taught us to love ancient American culture, just to be fascinated. So I don't just endlessly get out of Pembrey Village Library, the books about the Aztecs and the Incas, because it's in my Book of Mormon, you know. And the way we can now use technology to actually immerse ourselves in this world is to see what the conquistadors saw when they arrived at Tenochtitlan, which was the Aztec capital on this island in the middle of a lake that's now Mexico City. It blew their freaking minds. This city was bigger than anything in Europe and far more sophisticated. But they had guns and lots of diseases, so they ended up winning. So this is a recreation of Tenochtitlan in 1518. I'm going to flip through it quickly. It's from a website. So imagine you're looking into the valley and you see in the distance these causeways sort of crisscrossing this shallow lake to a city in the middle and these white buildings gleaming in the distance 500 years ago. And their agriculture was based on creating these kind of floating gardens that create kind of a basket with loads of soil and rubbish in, and it was very nutritious, and they got really high amounts of crops out of it. You know, they could crop several times a year, and fishing in the water and the stuff from those things made the lake very fertile for fish with lots of food for them, which could feed a massive population. So Cortez and his conquistadors walked up that with their smallpox. Just extraordinary. And that's just a little explanation. And they have also on the website there where you can slide the picture across to modern Mexico City. So you can see exactly the same locations and how they look now. Just astonishing. So if these were the Lamanites, I'm up for this. Wow, you know, there's some great stuff there. And if it all is a fantasy, this is one of the great gifts the Book of Mormon has given me, is to be fascinated by these amazing people and what they accomplished. Not so keen on human sacrifice, though. So we have here the temple of Huitzilopochtli. It took me ages to learn that, the war god. So they had some ethical issues, definitely. But look at that, amazing, all in Mexico. Maths is the basis of existence. We're going to get science-y and mathematical now. Let's learn some stuff.
The coolest thing I ever learned while studying quantum mechanics is that the functions that describe atomic orbitals were discovered 150 years before we even knew what an orbital was. Let me explain. Harmonics were first discovered in 1782 by Laplace. It refers to any function that satisfies the following differential equation. Spherical harmonics originate from solving this differential equation in a spherical domain, and they take on this general formula. You'll notice that this formula contains values m and l, which are also values that we use to denote atomic orbitals, but more on that in a second. We graph this function in 3D space with different values of m and l. 3D images that perfectly match the shapes of the atomic orbitals you may have learned in a chemistry class. How could a mathematician in the 1700s solve for these functions that had the ability to describe orbitals in an atom before he even knew what an atom was? Forgive the messiness, these are my actual notes from my quantum mechanics course. But in quantum mechanics, there's an equation that you solve over and over again. Pictured right here. An operator acting on some sort of wave function will always give you back that wave function as part of the solution, in addition to a component that will represent the energy of that wave function. If you've taken linear algebra, the wave function is your eigenfunction, and the energy is the eigenvalue. The Laplacian operator that was used to solve for the spherical harmonics, component of the Hamiltonian operator that solves for the kinetic energy of the wave function. Because the electrons that exist in an atom are described by wave functions, they exist in a 3D sphere surrounding the nucleus. The solution of this equation, if you consider a 1s electron in a hydrogen atom, matches the spherical harmonic solution of the more generalized Laplace differential equation. I mean, this really just proves that math is the blueprint for everything.
Yeah, I just said that perfectly. One thing you can encounter is the amazing range of human knowledge. You know, there are people who actually understood everything she just said there, and you can learn that stuff. And it sometimes opens your mind up to a greater world, but they'll kind of simplify it down in the sense that mathematical equations worked out centuries ago are literally describing what we're finding about the very weird behavior of subatomic particles and things. Another one to do with how imaginary numbers fit in, which we won't go into. A lot of this is adding up to the idea. Aspects of quantum physics are adding up to the idea that maybe we're living in a simulation, that a higher intelligence has designed our existence, almost like you would characters in a computer game. And there are very serious scientists taking that idea very seriously. For various reasons, which will hopefully become clear now.
We live in a huge universe, 200 billion trillion stars, and even if life is rare, you'd think there'd be some evidence of it somewhere. This is Fermi's paradox. But according to the Drake equation, there should be over a million technologically advanced civilizations just in our galaxy. And on average, the nearest one should be just a few hundred light years away. But there's nothing, at least not that we can see. So where is everybody? Are we really alone in the universe, or does our program only focus on us? And what about the physical rules that are in place? Max Tegmark, a cosmologist at MIT, said the strict laws of physics point to the possibility of a simulation. Putting a cap on the speed of light sure is a good way to keep your sims from venturing out too far from home. Theoretical physicist James Gates thought simulation theory was crazy. Then he started studying quarks and electrons. He found error-correcting code buried deep inside the equations used to describe string theory.
So you're saying as you dig deeper, you find computer code writ in the fabric of the cosmos?
Into the equations that we want to use to describe the cosmos, yes.
Computer code.
Computer code, strings of bits of ones and zeros.
Dr. Gates has changed his mind about simulation theory. In 2017, a group of scientists at the University of Washington proved they can embed computer code into strands of DNA. Everything in nature is math. Look at the Fibonacci sequence. You get the Fibonacci sequence by adding two previous numbers in the sequence together. So 1 plus 1 equals 2, 2 plus 1 equals 3, 3 plus 2 equals 5, 5 plus 3 equals 8, and so on forever. You get the golden ratio, also called phi, by dividing two consecutive Fibonacci numbers. So the number 89 is a Fibonacci number. The next number in the sequence after 89 is 144. 144 divided by 89 is the golden ratio. It's about 1.618. We see Fibonacci numbers and the golden ratio everywhere. The number of petals on a flower is usually a Fibonacci number. Lilies have 3 petals, buttercups have 5, chicory has 21, and a daisy has 34. And the spacing of each petal is arranged in a circle according to the golden ratio. As trees grow, the number of branches they form is a Fibonacci number. And not just plants, animals too. The ratio of female to male honeybees in a colony is the golden ratio, 1.618. The human body conforms to the golden ratio too. Most of the body follows the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 5. 1 nose, 2 eyes, 3 limb segments, 5 fingers, 5 toes. The proportions of the body, like the length of your shoulder to your elbow, and from your elbow to your fingertips, that's the golden ratio. Even a DNA molecule measures 34 angstroms long by 21 angstroms wide. Fibonacci numbers and the golden ratio. From the spiral of seashells to the spiral of a galaxy and everything in between, Fibonacci numbers are everywhere. Now, some claim this is a coincidence, that humans look for patterns in chaos because that's what we're programmed to do.
What we're programmed to do?
And isn't that interesting? By trying to debunk simulation theory, they actually end up proving it. No matter what we study, whether it's something the size of a galaxy or as small as an electron, everything in the universe seems to follow patterns and rules. In other words, a program.
So, science is sort of working its way back towards God in a sense, or a model for that, that in order to have, you know, structure and order and rules that all these different waveforms are following, you know, the idea that it does have to have some kind of organizing intelligence and so on, and that's something that, that, and you know, scientists and religious people and philosophers will continue to grapple with ad infinitum. But we do keep coming back to ideas that religion has had all along. Which I think, in a way, opens up some credibility for it, at least in some senses. I won't go into that, but this is like an amazing... Well, I'll do it quickly.
Let's get back to the details of how DRAM works and zoom in to explore a single memory cell situated in a massive array. This memory cell is called a 1T1C cell and is a few dozen nanometers in size. It has two parts, a capacitor to store one bit of data in the form of electrical charges, or electrons, and a transistor to access and read or write data. The capacitor is shaped like a deep trench dug into silicon, and is composed of two conductive surfaces separate.
And it goes on, but you have these, like, thousands and thousands of those ingrained and constructed in tiny silicon chips. You know, our technology is extraordinary. Having being able to see it in social media just helps you to visualize, to experience, to feel kind of the wonder of this all, where our technology is going, where our knowledge already is. This has got me very excited because we do pattern and tessellation at school in art and maths about shapes that can fit together without any gaps and repeat. And they finally found a mythical Einstein shape.
A new shape with 13 sides has been invented by mathematicians that can be tiled infinitely without ever repeating a pattern, making it the first example of an Einstein shape. This means that the shape can perfectly tile a surface without leaving any gaps or causing any overlap, and the pattern never repeats. Mathematicians have been searching for such a shape called the Einstein for decades. The shape was discovered by a retired printing technician from East Yorkshire, England, who called it the hat due to its vague resemblance to a fedora. The new shape was proven to be an aperiodic monotile, or an Einstein, by Smith and his co-authors through two proofs showing that it could tile a surface without ever repeating the pattern. Such aperiodic tilings have implications beyond mathematics, including their use in art and understanding the structure and behavior of quasi-crystals. I then 3D printed this shape and have turned it into a set of pieces to use as a puzzle or artistic demonstration of the unique tiling effect.
amazing. And you can use origami to engineer, again, an old tradition that, that is being used for lots of technological applications, often on a small scale. Simple folding solutions to create complex machines.
Engineers are turning to origami for inspiration for all types of applications, from medical devices to space applications, and even stopping bullets.
Just going to do, this was the best film I could find about quantum physics, just to explain it, and I think this is really cool, that again, you can get in just a few minutes an understanding of something actually high level, and understand what people are talking about when they're saying quantum physics. And it kind of all started with the double slit experiment. Has anyone heard of the double slit experiment? A few people have, okay.
The double slit experiment defies our understanding. It involves a laser shooting beams of light particles called photons at a screen with two parallel slits. If we mark all the spots where the photons hit the second wall, we should expect to see two strips to correspond with the two slits. But that's not what we see. Instead, we see an alternating pattern of light and dark bands. This is characteristic of the behavior of waves that pass through both slits simultaneously, interfering with each other to create the pattern on the second screen. The bright lines are where the top of waves meet, resulting in a more intense or brighter area on the screen. The darker bands are where the top of one wave meets the bottom of another, so they cancel each other out, resulting in a less intense or darker area on the screen. Here is a photo of a real interference pattern. The original double slit experiment was conducted in 1801 by British polymath Thomas Young. Since then, it's been performed with various types of particles, including electrons, and they were found to behave in the same way. This phenomenon occurs even if the photons are fired one at a time, which suggests that the photon is interfering with itself as it passes through both slits at once.
Physicists were so stumped that they decided to observe which slit the particle went through.
And that's when things get really weird. When scientists used a measuring device to observe the slit that each photon passed through, the interference pattern disappeared and the photons started behaving like particles. Instead of the spectrum of light and dark bands, we see two bright bands, indicating that the photons chose one slit or the other. So light can display characteristics of both particles and waves, known as wave-particle duality. It appears that light decides to behave as a wave when it's not being watched. It acts like a particle when it is being measured. The mere act of observing which slit it went through changed the behavior of the photons, almost as if they were aware they were being watched. It's kind of like how in a video game, the environment and objects only load when the player focuses on or interacts with them. The entire world isn't rendered all at once, allowing the game to save processing power and optimize resources. Likewise, light seems to behave like waves, but when we observe it, it's as if we're loading its properties, causing it to change and act like particles.
She challenges that, which is again why you keep learning and listening and finding more. So we've seen there that this is seen as one of the proofs of the simulation theory, that we're living in a program where on a subatomic level, all the energy is kind of could be lots of things, but doesn't waste energy being one in all places at once or resolving as something. But when you observe it or look at it or measure it, where it's needed, it suddenly becomes the thing you're looking for. She challenges that, says it's actually more to do with the intrinsic properties within those particles themselves. But anyway, that I won't get into all of that right now, but just to let you know there are different points of view. But this is where it's all going.
Exactly.
This is a quasicrystal that was mentioned earlier. If we live in a multidimensional space, and I've talked about this in my presentations at Sunstone before, scientists are proposing 11 dimensions of space where energy exists following different laws of physics. That's all you need for heaven, for hell, for your spirit body, for all of that to function, to be interacting with the things we have. And for a god to be able to transcend time and space, you just need to be able to function in some of these higher dimensions, because then you can move around the three-dimensional, four-dimensional space-time we're conscious of. And that's been explored in movies like Interstellar which is a really good movie that kind of has taken all this science to make it kind of a bit more accessible with a great space adventure, so I do recommend it. So,
see how I'm projecting this three-dimensional crystal to a two-dimensional image on the sand? See how the 2D projection looks distorted because of the angle of the projection? That 2D image also has a pattern, but it isn't periodic. So, it's not a crystal. But there's a deep connection between the 2D object on the sand and the 3D mother crystal. This distorted 2D pattern is called a quasicrystal. A quasicrystal in a certain dimension, in this case 2D, is a projection of a crystal in a higher dimension, in this case 3D. A group of physicists in Los Angeles is working on a new physics theory for a particular 8D crystal. Yep, that's right. An 8-dimensional crystal is projected to 4D at a very particular angle, which forms a 4D quasicrystal. And from this 4D quasicrystal, they derive a 3D quasicrystal, which they believe is the fundamental substructure of all reality. And this crystal is known as the E8 Less. To generate that 3D quasicrystal, the substructure of the pixelated fabric of reality, we project this 8D crystal to 4D. And then we convert that to 3D.
So this is, in a sense, where they're starting to prove that we are living in a very multidimensional universe. That we've got, so I'm just, I forgot to put my power lead in. And I'm a complete amateur on anything sciencey. You know, I got a pretty good grade for physics back in the day when it was O levels because I learned that all you need is to memorize one page of equations back then. But we can educate ourselves, we can stretch our brains, and there's no reason not to have that conversation at church on a Sunday. Why not show that? You know, we've been here for an hour, and we've covered a lot. We've covered philosophy, we've covered all of that. I'm just going to finish today, skipping through some stuff about biology. And
this is our new lab pet, Jerry. Jerry is a slime mold, and Jerry is a genius. Let me show you. We 3D printed these mazes, and then cast a very thin layer of agar into the bottom. Just enough to prevent Jerry from drying out, but it doesn't contain anything Jerry can actually eat. We place oat flakes at the beginning and end of the maze, and one right in the middle as a little treat, and then put a sample of Jerry at one end. What you're watching is a time lapse over the course of about 3 days. What's crazy is that all of the slime you see is actually one giant cell, and if a piece breaks off, it can just rejoin the main blob later. It's uncanny to see Jerry basically beeline for the first oat reward, and then after a whole day of chewing on their treat, they head what feels like straight for the end of the maze. Remember, this is a giant single cell with no neurons. And just like that, Jerry is done. Amoeba 1, maze 0. Next time, we're going to have to make it harder. Subscribe to follow along.
So what's going on there? This, on a molecular level. The branches of Jerry's cell are exploring. And there's a lot going in on
during
cells,
DNA
so
replication.
The last one
both strands of the double helix act as templates for the formation of new DNA molecules.
This is how DNA replicates within a cell. This is
copying occurs
at
a localized region.
This is how fast it happens.
Which is a Y-shaped structure where new DNA strands are synthesized by a multi-enzyme complex. Here, the DNA to be copied enters the complex from the left. One new strand is leaving at the top of frame, and the other new strand is leaving at the bottom. The first step in DNA replication is the separation of the two strands by an enzyme called helicase. This spins the incoming DNA to unravel it at 10,000 RPM in the case of bacterial systems. The separated strands are called 3' and 5'. Distinguished by the direction in which their component nucleotides join up. The 3' DNA strand, also known as the leading strand, is diverted to a DNA polymerase and is used as a continuous template for the synthesis of the first daughter DNA helix. The other half of the DNA double helix, known as the lagging strand, has the opposite 3' to 5' orientation and consequently requires a more complicated copying mechanism. As it emerges from the helicase, the lagging strand is organized into sections called Okazaki fragments. These are then presented to a second DNA polymerase enzyme in the preferred 5' to 3' orientation. These sections are then effectively synthesized backwards. When the copying is complete, the finished section is released and the next loop is drawn back for replication. Intricate as this mechanism appears, numerous components have been deliberately left out to avoid complete confusion. The exposed strands of single DNA are covered by protective binding proteins, and in some systems, multiple Okazaki fragments may be present.
That blew my mind more than anything. That's going on in every cell in our bodies all the time at that speed, in very complex interactions with lots of other cells doing the same stuff. And all of that is there for you on TikTok. Now, TikTok is apparently owned by the Chinese and they're using it as part of their scheme of world domination to take over our lives. So I feel nervous advocating for it. But my view is if all of us can spend more time on TikTok looking at the sciencey stuff rather than celebrities and their plastic surgery, the Chinese might be intimidated into realizing we're very, very clever people and we're not the degenerate West to be a pushover in a war and it could save our civilization. So I want everyone on TikTok looking at this stuff, please. Make those your algorithms, as mine have become. So, to conclude, there is amazing ways, very quickly, very easily, we can match all the wonder, the awe of the universe, the big questions about life and existence that you want to get from your religion, from many other places. And if you want your religion to be interesting, bring them into your religion, of course. As we heard in those first quotes, the ideal for Mormonism is meant to be. That is what you'd be getting on your Sunday. The science, the chemistry, Brigham Young used that terminology. Finding out how chemicals work, how life functions. That should be the scale and ambition of how we think, how we learn, because we're in the information age of the most extraordinary discoveries ever. We've discovered things in the last few years that have blown out of the water the progress made in previous centuries. And it's going to keep going on. And if I sit in another Sunday school where I'm told not to be interesting because it chases the Holy Spirit away, I'm going to do my nuts. Or start a podcast and just like let at them. Oh, I've already done that. So I hope there's lots of food for thought there. Get on your TikTok, discover this stuff. You don't have to wait months to hear something interesting on a Sunday. You can get it all in a 2-hour binge until your wife snatches the phone from you anytime you want. Thank you, everyone.